You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an author who tried to define what it means to be Midwestern and how our region fits in with the rest of the country. Now, for many of us, changes in our normal routine and surroundings take some getting used to these days. But for children and adults with autism spectrum disorder and other developmental disabilities, changes like this can be a big source of stress and anxiety. Our next guest joins us to offer some insights for people taking care of a child or teen living with autism spectrum disorder during the COVID-19 outbreak. Segan Hartley is an associate professor of human development and family studies and the 100 Women Chair in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She's a Wiseman Center investigator. Her research focuses on positive well-being in individuals with developmental disabilities and their family members. Segan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, the change in routine I know can be challenging for just about anyone. What kind of specific challenges do you see for families with children with autism?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, you're right. I feel like the COVID-19 pandemic has really altered daily life for many of us, right? And many of the challenges that I think families with children with autism and other types of developmental conditions face are the same challenges that families who have typically developing children face as well. But I also think there's some added challenges for these families that we've heard from the families that we interact with. So, you know, for example, if you think about families who have a child or adolescent with autism or another type of condition, you know, these are children who often are not able to access important services and treatments that used to be offered through schools or clinics or health providers. And many of these are services that were offered on a daily or weekly level. So, and many of these are services that are really essential to helping that child learn new skills and manage their emotions and their behaviors. So now, not only are they not able to access some of the school services, which is sort of a universal experience right now, they're not accessing all these additional therapies and supports and services that they used to get that are really important for their daily lives. So I think that's one thing that these families are facing that's unique. The other thing that you see a reduction in right now is services for parents and other caregivers in that family. So respite care services, for example, is a service that was often vital to families and will provide a needed break so that parents could engage in other activities that may be beneficial for their own well-being and coping and have some time apart from that child. And because of social distancing and some of the new COVID-19 policies, often families are not able to access these respite care services. So parents or siblings or other family members who take on these care responsibilities are now taking on more responsibility. So not just acting as the parents, but now also that special education teacher, that occupational therapist, that speech and language therapist, but they're also getting less break. So I would say that's sort of one important way that these families have some added challenges.
What are some of the ways a caregiver can build routines now in this sort of disrupted environment that's going to be good for the kid they're caring for, but also help hopefully meet some of their own needs as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I do think, you know, an important point when we think about some of these families is just how important daily routines are. So many of us, you know, myself included, really thrive with a daily routine. And that makes us feel good. This is a key part to sort of how we maintain our behavior and our well-being. And what we find is that routines are even more important for many individuals who have autism and other types of developmental conditions. So this is a critical way that we teach these children and teens behaviors. So this is how we teach them new skills. This is also how we convey what types of behaviors are appropriate and not appropriate, so what they should be doing. And it can make their world more predictable. So for children who may not have that same developmental level understanding as their peers, this is a way that we can help make sure that they know what's coming next. So they play really important roles. So, you know, I think during this time, one of the critical challenges faced by these parents is really how to establish a new routine that can work for their family, given sort of these limitations that they're all under one shared roof they can't necessarily go access some of the things that they're used to that may have been really good coping mechanisms, like going to the zoo or going to certain parks or going to a playground. And so developing a new routine. So I think, one piece of advice for how to do this is to, just make sure that parents are sort of setting realistic expectations. It's okay to recognize that this is a completely new challenge, that families are under stress. There's a lot going on. Things are changing every day. And so this is going to take time to develop these new routines. And so think about breaking it down into little steps, knowing that it's likely that you're going to try to set a routine and may have to adjust it until you find a good match for something that's feasible and that you can continue to do day after day for both from your child's point of view. It's a good match for their attention, for the sort of types of sensory stimulation they need, but also is manageable for parents. So we don't want to set up, expectations that parents really, that's so burdensome that there's just no way that you could sustain that level of assistance or activity with that child. So really sort of, I think, take a realistic approach to trying to do it. And I think recognizing and expecting that there's going to be failures along the way.
And Segan, give
yourself a break.
We have just a few moments left. Are we seeing online resources emerge to help take over from some of those things that used to be part of a daily or weekly treatment routine?
Yes, absolutely. So a lot of organizations have developed some wonderful toolkits to both have a conversation about what COVID-19 is with children who are on the spectrum, who have other types of developmental issues. So Autism Speaks is one that has a lot of resources. The American Psychological Association, Division 33, also has a lot, as well as the CDC. And so those would be great toolkits. I think they offer social narratives, so pictures and stories, about both how to set new routines and how to talk about COVID-19.
Segan, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Segan Hartley, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. She's also a Wiseman Center investigator. She joins today to share some tips for families with a member who has autism or other developmental disorders. Coming up, we'll talk to two Wisconsin college students who are preparing for a national solar home design competition while having to stay apart from their team members. That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, solar houses designed and built by Wisconsin students are in the works. We'll talk to an engineer and an architect about their design for a national competition. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a Wisconsin artist who recently passed away.
Dr. Evermore turned bits of metal and other salvage parts into fantastic sculptures, beginning in 1983. People can find his truly one-of-a-kind works of art behind Delaney's Surplus near Baraboo. There, he created a whole world of mechanical creatures, insects, birds, and other contraptions. Dr. Evermore, or Tom Every, passed away last week at age 81. To remember this Wisconsin artistic giant, we're going to revisit this story from a few years ago when reporter Gilman Halstead went to talk with the artist about his sculptures.
I am Tom Every from Brooklyn, Wisconsin, the junk dealer. And now I am Dr. Evermore, the crazy guy, okay?
Evermore spent years running a salvage and demolition company. He saved industrial machinery parts from the more than 300 factories, breweries, power plants, and rail cars he dismantled and collected others. He became convinced these obsolete pieces of metal had become imbued with the spirit of their original creators and decided to make them into pieces of art that embodied that spirit.
We're working with pre-existing shapes and forms that lose their original identity, become something else, without altering any of them. So that is one of the Ten Commandments, okay? So when we look at something, it's plenty good the way it is, now how can we use it?
Dr. Evermore has created a myth about himself and his art. It begins with his first and most ambitious work, the Forevertron.
I am a slight rebel, and I don't particularly like certain entities, which I don't really care to name. Such as the establishment. I thought that I could get back into the heavens. That's where this thing came from. This is designed to perpetuate yourself back into the heavens in a glass ball, in a copper egg, on a magnetic lightning force beam. It is a could be fantasy, and that's what it is, but it is built of the real material.
The real material the Forevertron is made of includes a 6,000-pound transformer from an old powerhouse dam in Prairie du Sac, a huge compressor from a Sheboygan power plant, and what the doctor calls a decontamination chamber. It was actually used by Apollo astronauts. The entire spaceship weighs more than 300 tons. Built in the 1980s with the help of a few friends, it's the centerpiece of the Evermore Sculpture Park, nestled in a grove of cottonwood trees on Highway 12 in Sauk County, across the road from the old Badger Army ammunition plant. In a nearby meadow are a bizarre assortment of huge metal birds with long ostrich-like necks and elaborate crowns of metal feathers. Some of the birds have musical instruments welded into their bodies, guitars, French horns, saxophones, trumpets. The feathers on these birds are flattened pieces of metal that can be played like chimes. They stand watching the Forevertron, ready to strike up the band when it's time for its celestial voyage. But before he takes off in the Forevertron, Dr. Evermore would like to pass on some of his skills to young artists with their own visions. He'd like to see the park become a studio for welders like him who enjoy giving new life to old metal.
All I can leave anybody is something, not any big bank accounts or anything else, and say unto you or anybody else, you can do it. Power on.
That story on Tom Every, also known as Dr. Evermore, came to us from Gilman Halstead, a former reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Evermore passed away last week at the age of 81. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, in-person classes may not be happening, but that hasn't stopped a team of students from UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee from continuing work on a solar house design project. Engineers from Madison and architects from Milwaukee are finalists in the U.S. Department of Energy's Race to Zero Solar Decathlon competition. They're trying to develop the most sustainable climate change-fighting homes possible. The event was supposed to take place in person later this month, but rather than cancel it altogether, the competition is going forward online. We have two of the team members with us. Ryan McKernan is a senior mechanical engineering student at UW-Madison, and Rachel Schultz is a graduate first-year Master of Architecture student at UW-Milwaukee. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Rachel, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Rachel, on the architecture side of things, can you tell us a little bit about the designs you've done for this competition? What are you shooting for on these on the houses you're working on?
So the intent behind the houses are for them to be zero net production homes. So we started by making a set of these schematic design homes, and we intended to use traditional architectural style homes. We went with like a Craftsman Art and Craft style. That's the Solar Decathlon submitted style home. We also have the traditional farmhouse style home as another production style. And we have a homestead similar to another farmstead home.
And Rachel, this isn't just taking a standard house design, as I understand it, and slapping on some solar panels. You're really going into the nuts and bolts to try to hit that zero emission standard, right?
Yes, we're diving into a lot of different things to do with like energy, materials, even our walls, which are made out of the SIPs. We're using a lot of more efficient appliances. We did a whole semester of research into how to produce the best net zero energy home. And it also has to do with how the homeowner takes care of the home and how they react in their home, and how much they try to reduce their water usage, their electric usage, things like that.
And Ryan, on the engineering side of thing, what are these designs, what kind of unique challenges do they present in figuring out how to bring them to life?
So obviously, like Rachel said, we did a lot of research in the net zero house kind of department. And what we found was that kind of, although sticking on solar panels does eventually get it to net zero, the most important thing when building a net zero house is the airtightness of the house itself and really managing the thermal barrier. So if you think of a house, it's kind of just a big heat transfer problem. And you want to really mitigate the heat transfer in and the heat transfer out, but also optimizing the various kind of solar heat that you can gain. And there's a bunch of different variables that kind of factor into the whole design, but basically just optimizing that into the best house design possible.
And Ryan, what kind of things did you do to try to meet that challenge of limiting that that heat transfer you were just talking about?
So we introduced SIPs, which are structural insulated panels, and what they do is kind of get rid of the thermal bridging that takes place in normal houses, and this happens across of the wood studs. And so this basically takes away that thermal bridging aspect of it and also increases the air tightness by basically stacking up these panels like Legos, creating a very tight gap in between the panels itself.
Now, Rachel, let's turn to this competition itself now. The idea, it was originally, I think, your team would be together in person collaborating on this. Then you go to an in-person competition. How have things like safer at home orders and canceling these big gatherings, how's that affected the process for you all?
It's definitely affected a lot. We were originally supposed to send out five of us to Denver, Colorado, to do an in-person presentation, and now obviously we can't all go there. So we're all recording at our own homes, and we have one of our team members are snipping together all of our recordings of our script is what we're going to say and placing them together in a video. It's kind of interesting because this way you can like know exactly what you're going to say and not get like if you were on stage, get all nervous and mess up. You can tweak everything to how you want it to be, and you can lay out the video into a format that makes it really graphic and visual and really appealing to the judges, since you can't physically be there in person, so they can't physically see you and relate to you. You can try to convey that through video now.
Ryan, does the fact that this is a competition, you're up against teams from all over the country, does that inspire you to come up with more creative solutions here?
Definitely does, especially looking at the past proposals and projects from the previous years and kind of seeing the level that they submitted their projects to. It really kind of amplified our team and the architects to kind of really step up. And this being said, this is the first year where we actually have kind of the architects leading the role. As Rachel may have said, there's 19 architects and 8 engineers. So we have a pretty big team kind of tackling this, and this kind of really made it easier for us to get things done, but also harder to dictate who has what position and kind of getting things done on time. But I think overall, as looking at competing against other universities, we had a pretty decent proposal this year, and I'm happy with what came out of it.
And Rachel, this isn't just going to exist in blueprint form. I understand there will be 3 houses ultimately built. What's going to happen? Where are those going to be?
Yeah, so one is going to be the Verona house, which was the one submitted to the competition. This will be in like a suburb on the outskirts of Madison. It's for the Golden family. They agreed to be a part of the competition as well as 2 other clients. The other clients are in Danbury, which is really northern Wisconsin, as well as the Homestead home will be really northern Wisconsin near Minneapolis area. These homes should be built. I think the Verona one, we are able to better track the energy and better keep track of how our net zero has taken place.
Ryan, are you excited ultimately to see your work end up, in actual building form around the state?
Oh, yeah. I think especially being from Madison and having Verona kind of right there. It'll be cool to see it actually being built and then the finished product. But I thought the coolest aspect of it was meeting the actual clients in person in December and kind of showing them our iterations and getting feedback from them to kind of see where the process was going and what they wanted versus what they didn't want.
And Rachel, that reminds me, before I let you both go, part of the challenge here wasn't just to build a great energy efficient house. It was to build one that would work here in Wisconsin, right? How much of the Wisconsin environment informed your designs?
It definitely informed us a lot, especially looking into the climate zone. We had to think about how to make sure the basement was misconfigured, how thick our insulation would be. We had to think about what kind of native plants we would use, even in the landscaping, and even just like the roof pitches and angles and overhangs that came in with the certain sun angles. And also just like the environment here, it's cold most of the year, and the house includes some features that you can still enjoy your outdoor weather, even when it starts to hit those like temperatures that are a little chillier.
Well, good luck, and thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Rachel Schultz, graduate first-year Master of Architecture student at UW-Milwaukee. We also heard from Ryan McKernan, senior mechanical engineering student at UW-Madison. We talked to them today about their sustainable solar home design for the U.S. Energy Department's national competition. Coming up, defining what it means to be Midwestern isn't always easy. We'll talk with an author who looked to history, literature, pop culture, and his own life to try to figure it out. You could share your thoughts on what the Midwest is, geographically, culturally, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to the state leaders of both major parties about the latest news in an unusual election week here in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, think about what it means to be Midwestern. Maybe things like humble or hardworking or friendly come to mind. But beyond a few familiar words, maybe some stereotypes, it can be a surprisingly tough question to answer. Our next guest looked back into history, literature, and his own life to try to pin down what Midwestern identity is all about, how we fit into the American story, and what the region's future could look like. Philip Christman is a lecturer in the English department at the University of Michigan. He's the author of the new book, Midwest Futures. It's out this week. Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, in your book, you talk about the different ways we try to define the Midwest historically, culturally, even geographically. However you slice it, it's a slippery topic. Why is it so hard to pin down what Midwestern means?
Well, I mean, it's partly because the concept, it's kind of one of those concepts or ideas that got born more than one time for more than one ideological purpose. So, you know, I mean, when we try to think about what the Midwest is, I mean, do we start during the you know, colonial and revolutionary period when this was the old, what's now called the Old Northwest Territory, you know, when Ohio was the area that was like to the west of the original 13 colonies? Does Midwest mean, you know, the like the part of the, like all of the stereotypes from the early 20th century about, you know, rurality and, you know, the L. Frank Baum kind of world, you know, what are we really talking about? I mean, it's a huge amorphous region that doesn't kind of naturally have any one thing connecting itself. So all we have is history, and history says different things.
Right. And I think one concept sometimes is that it's this sort of timeless, unchanging place. And you tackle that by digging into the history. And you point out that, okay, we kind of assume in American history that the Midwest just sort of happened naturally. And you dug into the specific reasons that speculators and others had an interest in this region in the first place. Can you spell out some of that story for us?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating story. And quite frankly, a general rule that I learned from doing the research for this book about how to live your intellectual life is like, man, whatever the stereotypical story is, just assume that it's covering like the exact diametric opposite. Right. And that's definitely true about the Midwest. You know, so it's been a region that's like very future obsessed and has always, you know, played a role in this country's dreams about its own future. So, yeah, I mean, like, first of all, like, again, getting back to the immediate like post-colonial revolutionary period. I mean, what was the Midwest to the people you know, who constituted the government of the new United States? Well, it was a place where they were all making different competing land claims, right? Like George Washington had so many land claims out this way that, you know, like it was basically a foreordained question for him whether he was going to do everything he could to make sure that there were no natives living in this area anymore so that he could buy and sell this land. And that's true for lots of people. And then as that process went forward, it also became a place where people sort of dreamed big utopian dreams, right? And it, you know, it became a site where people dreamed sort of as time went on, like big dreams about what big capitalism could mean, or you know, the future of business, the future of technology. So, I mean, this has been the staging ground for several different visions of what the American future could look like. It's precisely not timeless and unchanging.
And you mentioned Native Americans, and I think when we think in our, you know, history classes and our pop culture, we see the Native Americans with the settlers in the 1600s. We see them in the Old West. This huge story happened here in the Midwest, and we just kind of—I don't know—we blink it away. Why did that disappear so much, where these other ends of the story maybe didn't?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would argue that it disappeared because, you know, it had to disappear, you know, or like, you know, quite frankly, a lot of us wouldn't be able to live with ourselves, especially, you know, the more powerful and privileged you are, the more you wouldn't be able to live with yourself, because what was done to the Native Americans was and is, you know, just kind of criminal and really, really ongoing ways. And and also, I think another reason that we don't hear as much about Native American history is, you know, Noam Chomsky, when he talks about Cuba and kind of like how insistent the United States has always been that like no socialist Latin American regime can prosper. And that's not to say that there haven't been like terrible dictatorial socialist regimes all around the world. But, you know, the insistence that we can't let like a Pinochet or whatever do, or that we can't let a Salvador Allende do anything right or get any credit for it, is the threat of a good example. And I think to some extent, the suppression of the Native American story is also about the threat of a good example. This is a group of people that is less destructive of its natural environment than white people tend to even be able to be. Like I wouldn't even know how to be as earth careful as a lot of Native intellectuals are, you know, even if I wanted to be, like, my life ways, the structures that I have to live in don't permit it. So, like, these days I'm actually looking to Native American scholarship and activism as an inspiration, what people accomplished at Standing Rock and places like that, for a future that isn't just, like, completely, you know, defined by runaway climate change.
Talking to Philip Christman. His new book is Midwest Futures. It's out this week. He digs deep into history, literature, and more to try to figure out what Midwestern identity means. Philip, you, as I mentioned, looked into literature, and you found from the beginning of European settlement in the area this sense of Midwestern as a synonym for boring in a lot of ways. How did we establish boringness as a stereotype, both among us as Midwesterners and from people on the coast?
Well, I think definitely part of that story, and this also something that's covered really well in a book by James Shortridge called The Middle West from the mid 80s, which was a book that I use a lot in my book. He talks about how as the country was sort of like on the tipping point between the U.S. as a whole was on the tipping point between being a primarily urban or a primarily rural culture, that kind of the image of, you know, my old Kansas grandparents, you know, my old Minnesota, you know, farmstead, you know, the kind of little house on the prairie imagery that became really important to the culture because it was a way of kind of enshrining and memorializing this pioneer narrative that was important for people's self-esteem and self-concept in a time when, like, you know, most people are just not going to be pioneers anymore. You're not going to be pioneers in the literal sense. You're going to be clocking in for your shift at the factory, because that's what our economy is now, right?
And then in pop culture, something I've noticed over the years is that, okay, you're putting a sitcom, say, in New York, and you want the sort of everyman character or the naive person in the big mm-hmm. city. Let's make him be from Wisconsin or somewhere else mm-hmm. in the Midwest. That we're kind of a stock character in pop culture in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sometimes actually, there's a famous quip to this effect that from the painter, American Gothic guy, Grant Wood. Mm-hmm. The East kind of thinks of the Midwest as a colony of the East, and that is very much how how. I don't like to get into these, like, kind of anti-coastal narratives,
sure.
Too much, but that can get kind of reactionary. But yeah, I mean, to some extent, narratives that are spun in LA, New York, these places that see themselves as the centers, the cultural centers of the country, do kind of fall into seeing people from anywhere else as kind of raw material. Right. You have to come east in order to become a full human being, you know, or you have to go to LA in order to be refined into a full human being. And it's ridiculous. I mean, I've never been happier than, you know, when I was living in the Twin Cities. It's, you know, or when I was living in Milwaukee during grad school. Like, those are great cities. If you're tired of them, you're tired of life.
We're talking to Phil Christman, author of the new book Midwest Futures, about the Midwest region's place in the story of America, of American culture, and how its residents, I guess us, how we fit in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you had to try to define the Midwestern identity, what would you say? Do you see positives and negatives, maybe both at the same time? Why do you think the Midwest sometimes becomes a synonym for normal or maybe even boring? What is the Midwest geographically? Who counts? Do we in Wisconsin? I think most people say so, not everybody. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Phil Christman, author of the new book, Midwest Futures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it means to be Midwestern? Is there a common cultural identity, for better or worse? What's the good, the not so good parts of life in the region? What do you think has created Midwestern sensibilities and quirks we have, the stereotypes people have of us, the stereotypes we have of them, whoever they are outside the Midwest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Phil, you mentioned, often the stereotype turns out to be the opposite of the reality. Another example you give in the book is the idea that, Midwestern farmers were isolationist, when in fact farmers 100 years ago and today are very interested in the world and hopefully selling their products to the rest of it. Could you talk about why that stereotype, again, doesn't quite match reality?
Yeah, and a big influence. I always try to shout out my influences. a big influence here was Kristen Hoganson's book, The Heartland, which came out last year, and it's a history of the concept of the Heartland. It's good. It's really, really good. And yeah, she talks extensively about that. Like, she actually went through and read all these old farming trade journals from the 19th and early 20th century, which is just heroic scholarly labor that I would never have the endurance to do. And yeah, there was absolutely an interest in, one, just understanding world markets, because farming is an insanely difficult business, and like full of risk, and so much of like the history of currency itself, like going back hundreds of years, has to do with, and the history of insurance and risk just has to do with trying to take some of the chanciness out of farming. And two, more specifically, there was fear that we were going to get U.S. farmers and Midwestern farmers in particular were going to get outcompeted by Latin American farmers, because the soil there is so good. The soil in some parts of Latin America is quite fruitful, right? Midwesterners did not want to be outflanked there. That conversation goes back to the 19th century. I the idea of isolationist or disengaged from the world is, more generally, I guess I always think that that's kind of a problematic label, because disengaging is often anyway kind of a form of engaging, right? I mean, people usually have arguments for why the particular way in which I intend to disengage from the market or from the world scene is, like, quote unquote, better, or will lead to a better outcome for everybody. So I feel like it's a misnomer to begin with.
And I'll mention, we talked to Sarah Smarsha here on the show about that very book. It's been a year or two now. We're talking to Phil Christman right now, author of the new book, Midwest Futures. Phil, you mentioned in the book that your own hometown, I think it was Alma, Michigan, has been featured in a couple different scholarly studies under a pseudonym in some cases. Blankton, was it? Or something really generic like
literally.
That. So your very hometown was picked as sort of this generic representation of the Midwest. What's that like?
That was surreal. That was like the moment in the research process when it just felt most Twilight Zone-y, because I don't know how much other people who grew up in like Midwest farm towns or who grew up in that particular town feel this way. And I don't want to project my own mindset too much on other people, but I mean, I just always felt like I really did live in the middle of nowhere. If I were to turn on the TV news and someone even said the word Alma, I would have been like surprised. Right. It just felt like there was like an invisible dome that repelled attention. And I remember feeling that way so far back I don't even know, you know, when I started to feel that way, like deep, deep, you know, back in childhood. And, you know, some parts of the book, I try to figure out where that came from. So in the process of researching this book, I discovered that there are two dissertations from the early 20th century that are just about the economy of my town, which, like, to be clear, 10 to 12,000 people in this place, not a huge population center. One of them, and they both specifically say that the reason they wanted to write about my little Michigan farm town is because it's just so representative. I mean, this, you know, and you find that in other social science from the early 20th century. Most famously, that book Middletown by the Robert and Helen Lind, where they write an analysis of a town, and it's Muncie, Indiana, but they call it Middletown. And they actually say, when we were looking for the normalest place we could possibly investigate, of course we knew it had to be a Midwestern town. Like, they don't even feel the need to explain why they think that. It's just like, oh, duh, of course. And that's basically the reason that both of these economists give. And yeah, one of them, to preserve confidentiality, I guess, calls it Blankton, which is like, it's a compliment and an insult. And you know, that at the same time, that way of thinking about the Midwest as so normal and so average has, like, in one way, it gives us too much credit, makes us kind of like this generic pattern for humanity. And then in another way, it's deeply insulting and causes us not to actually see, as individuals, communities, whatever, and regionally, our own particularities at all.
A quick correction. I said Sarah Smarsh. The Heartland book we were talking about was Kristen Hoganson. She's the one who was on the show in the past. Just in our last minute or so, Phil, talk about the future now a little bit. What roads ahead briefly do you see for us here in the Midwest?
Yeah. Well, I think that we should be, I'm just going to be very, very specific and say that we should be extremely suspicious of and strongly resist any attempts to privatize the Great Lakes, because, you know, the world is getting warmer and smaller, and people are going to want, you know, people are going to want to privatize and fence off as much of 20% of the world's freshwater as they possibly can in a world that's like that. And, you know, I think we can kind of think of the Great Lakes as a little bit of a bellwether for how the struggle to keep the commonwealth truly common is going.
We'll leave it there, Phil. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
You too. That's Philip Christman, a lecturer in the English department at the University of Michigan. He joined us for a look at his new book out this week called Midwest Futures, looking into history, literature, pop culture, and more to try to figure out what Midwestern identity is, what it is geographically, and what the future could look like here in the region. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll find out how different congregations are adapting major religious holidays in a time of physical distancing. A lot of big celebrations going on this week and in the weeks to come. We'll want to hear from you about how your own congregation might be handling things like Passover, Easter, getting ready for Ramadan, whatever your particular holiday might be. We want to hear how you are treating that in a time of physical distancing. We generally think of gratitude as a good thing, but how does it work and who does it help? The thanker or the thankee, the person who's being thanked? We'll dig into the deeper meaning of the concept and practice of gratitude. And the movie business is taking a big hit during the coronavirus outbreak, and viewers are changing their habits. Reggie the Real Critic is back with us to look at what's happening and not happening on the big screen lately, and we'll want to hear from you. Tell us what you are watching and how you're watching it. You can get started right now. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. All that and more, it's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Milwaukee has been the hardest hit community in Wisconsin in the coronavirus pandemic so far. Kate talks to the city's health commissioner. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, in the last 72 hours, we saw coronavirus have a big impact on the state's election. How does all of that impact voters' behavior? We'll take a closer look with a political scientist from Beloit College. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.